I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
That's
how you do this, Mitch. AA takes away a lot of things. It also gives you a lot of things. AA has given me 7 daughters, none of which I get to spank or give them their own names, but, you know, I still have 7 girls that love me, like, most of the time. Most of them want to argue most of the time. And our speaker tonight's one of them. She's the eldest of my 7 girls. She's probably the biggest. Anyway, she's just hard to deal with sometimes. And it takes a lot. You know, she does. She works her program through her sponsor of the program. And she does a lot of service work. She does a lot of good. None of it she did, you know, skipping down the road. She's got claw marks all over everything. And, but it takes a lot for her to get up here and talk in front of you, to give herself to you. So, but she's just like you. Just like you. God help you. And I love her. And here's Kat.
I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. And as he said, I don't like being up in front of people at all. Okay, so my sobriety date is May 22nd, 2010. I'm from Atlanta, born in Piedmont Hospital, grew up in Buckhead. So, let's see here. My first drink was when I was 4 years old. My parents used to have 4th of July parties and oyster parties. And so one year, I remember seeing, you know, everybody was running around having fun, laughing and everything, and they were all drinking out of these little yellow plastic cups. And so I figured, well, everything in the plastic cups are coming from this silver thing that had the tube and blah, blah, blah. So I decided one time when my dad got up from sitting next to the keg that I would go and, you know, try it. So I went over and, you know, tried some of the beer directly out of the keg, and that was interesting. 4 years old, I don't remember much after that. So, but I do remember drinking out of the tube. I have a younger brother. He's 9 years younger than me. When he was born, I was in the delivery room. I was rooting for a girl, but it was a boy, and we're very good friends now. A few months after that, I ended up starting to have seizures. And so my mom was dealing with an infant and then with an epileptic daughter, and we had to do tests and everything. It's controlled by medication now, but that's really when I truly started to feel different, because I couldn't do things like other people, you know, sports and stuff like that when I was little, until they figured out how to control it and how to handle it. Is it hot in here, or is it just me? Let's see here. In high school, that's when I started drinking. I wasn't like a heavy drinker or anything like that. That was more in college. But my mom had told me, she said, if you ever come home drunk or any other thing, I've done it all, so I know, you know, what's going on. I know that you've done something. And so that kind of scared me into not doing anything at home, because my real dad, not my AA dad, is 6'2" and is built like a refrigerator, so I was scared to death of him. Not to mention the fact that he was not the nicest father in the world anyway. He's one of us, but, you know, doesn't claim to be one of us. So I would go over to friends' houses. I would do everything I could not to have to come home so that I could get drunk. That would happen every once in a while. I had a curfew of 10 o'clock until I was a senior. So, yeah, basically I was always over at somebody else's house. I never felt like I was good enough for anything. In high school, I went to a private school. I did, you name it, I did it. I was on the flag corps. I was a basketball manager. I played volleyball. I was a wrestlerette, a.k.a. mat maid, for anybody that doesn't know. I wasn't wrestling, not at all. But I never felt like I could do anything up to the standards, you know. That was just me. The year that I graduated from high school, I went on a beach trip that I had organized with some of my friends, and we had to have a chaperone. So I asked my cousin to be a chaperone, and he was, he's 5 years older than me. So he provided all the pot, all the alcohol, anything that we needed, we just asked him to, hey, we need to re-up. So, but, of course, I was really the only one that was smoking pot. And there was a few others that were drinking, but mostly me. Oh, yeah, and drugs are in my story, so if you don't like it, my bad. College, that's, I ended up going over to Ole Miss. Barely, I was able to make it. But I went over there. My drinking started, like, really took off over there because I didn't have to go to class if I didn't want to. I didn't have to, you know, I didn't have a curfew, nothing like that because I was very sheltered at home. I had a curfew. I had to do this. I had to do that. Whereas in college, I didn't have to do anything if I didn't want to. It was more along the lines of, okay, I got into a sorority, so once I get into the sorority, I go and just go to the sorority fraternity parties and just get hammered. I'd get a fifth of Jack Daniels and pour it into one of the college mugs, and I'd walk around the Grove drinking that. And I'd also have a Coke, like a 2-liter of Coke or something, and I'd pour it into the Jack Daniels to water it down, even though I drank a bunch of it just straight. I don't know. And let's see, so my sorority ended up kicking me out for pot. Because I was dealing it to my other sorority sisters, one of my sorority sisters told on me, and I had actually gotten her stoned, so I don't know what that was all about. But so, yeah, so they politely asked me to leave, and I ended up staying at Ole Miss for a couple of more semesters, I think. But I didn't realize you had to go to class in order to continue to go to school and be involved in school. So they sent me a letter saying, please do not come back to our institution. I said, okay. I stayed over there, went to a community college over there because I didn't want to come home because I had more freedom over there, you know, no parents around and nothing. At the community college, what I'd do is I'd get up, I'd go to class, which I had scheduled for in the afternoon, and after class, I would go to the gas station. I'd pick up a case of beer and a six-pack of beer. I would take the case and some ice to one of my roommates where she worked, and so that they could drink in the afternoon, and then I would take the six-pack that I got and a little bit of ice, and I would drive around the back streets or back roads in Oxford and get drunk and smoke pot, and then I'd make sure to be home by 5 o'clock so that when everybody started to get off work, I would be there. You know, I'd have my parking spot. Nobody else can park in my parking spot. And then other stuff was brought into the picture back then. A lot of different types of drugs. When I came back to Atlanta in December of 99, the whole reason I came back is because my parents said, either you come back or we're going to cut you off. And I was like, well, I still need some extra money from my parents. That would be really nice. So I think I'll just go ahead and come back. I moved into an apartment when I got back from Mississippi, and it was directly across the street from a bar. So I could walk to and from the bar if I needed to, which I needed to all the time. I worked in the restaurant industry. I almost got my associate's degree in medical office technology. However, I missed it by one class. But I would lie to everybody saying that I got it so I could get a job in the medical field, which I hated. But I stayed in the restaurant industry in between. I was in the restaurant industry for about 12 years. Which is a great breeding ground for alcoholics and drug addicts, because I would have stuff delivered to me, you know. I'd just call the guy and be like, hey, and you know, I'm not completely awake or with it today, so can you drop me off something? My last job, I worked at a brewery, so, you know, the brewmaster would bring over the beer and would be like, hey, what do you think about this one? So I would be like 3 sheets to the wind by the time that, you know, the dinner service already started, which I loved. I had no problem with that. I ended up getting my first DUI in, 2006, and I had hit a tree head-on the other side of the road in the blackout. I don't remember any of it. I remember a guy pulling me out of the car saying, hey, you were just in an accident. I was like, no, I wasn't. He said, yeah, you were. I was like, no, I wasn't. He said, look at your car. I was like, oh, shit. And so, oh, sorry, cuss word. I'm trying not to cuss. Anyway, so he was on the phone. I remember him being on the phone, and I was like, get off the phone. The cops are going to come. I've been drinking. The next thing I remember, my parents were there. I was sitting on the hood or leaning on the hood of a cop car, and the cop was asking me to walk a straight line. And I said to him, I said, look at me. Look at my car. Do you think I can walk a straight line? And he said, please, ma'am, I need you to at least just try. And so I took two steps, started to fall over, and ended up in jail. And I think I blew, that time I blew 0.191. And so then, you know, I was on probation, did everything that I had to do, the community service. But 5 months later, that didn't stop me. 5 months later, I got another DUI. Same street, same county, about half a mile away from where I hit the tree. So needless to say, I stay out of Cobb County and I stay off of Paces Ferry. So after the second one, when I went to court, I had to spend 9.5 days in jail. And for me, 9.5 days in jail felt like 9.5 years. I did make friends in jail, though. I made friends with Big Mama. She loved me. I gave her my honey bun. She took care of me. And the day before I left, I found out that she was in there for attempted manslaughter. So I had the best kind of person taking care of me. So, but anyway, so when I finally went to court, the judge said, okay, you can either go to rehab or you can do 9 months in jail. So I said, I'll take rehab. I mean, you know, what's the option there? I mean, you know. So I went to this rehab in North Carolina, and it was great. I fished. I played with cats, played with horses. We exercised. We played badminton. And occasionally we'd do a class on the big book, you know. So that was kind of interesting. It was a great, great rehab, lots of exercise. Got a lot of sun that 30 days. So I came back, and I had to do the 90 and 90 and do the community service, all that stuff that's required. I had a little machine in my car, all that crap. But 4 months, let's see, so I did the 90 and 90. I actually came here the first time. And it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't time for me. It wasn't. I stayed, after I stopped doing the required, getting my sheet signed, you know, coming in and out, whatever, I was like, okay, I'm going to prove to you guys I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm going to stay sober. I think I stayed sober a total of 4 months on my own, white-knuckling it. I would still go to the bars with my friends and sit there and drink Coke or water while everybody else is drinking, doing shots, and going to the bathroom to do Coke. You know, and it was like, talk about not changing playmates and playgrounds. Finally, one day, I was just like, screw it. So I ended up about 4 years, I did everything possible to try and ruin my life. I did drugs. I shouldn't. Since I'm epileptic, epilepsy affects the brain. I know a lot of people who have seizures or who I've heard of people who've had seizures detoxing. The entire time I was drunk, I never had a seizure. The entire time I was doing shrooms or acid or whatever, I never had a seizure. So it's kind of, you know, when I finally got sober, it was like, you know, I talked to my doctor. My doctor's like, you are extremely lucky to be alive with some of the pills and stuff. I mean, it's amazing. But so when I went back out and I was drinking for a while, I mean, I had everything from like, you know, I mean, alcoholic relationships. There's one guy I dated for a while, and he ended up, when we broke up, he was in the bar with me or in the same bar, and he ended up calling me names, and I got pissed, and so I took my beer mug over there and tried to dump it on him, and I missed, and so I took my beer mug, and I threw it at him, and it shattered all over. This was in a pool hall. It shattered all over 3 pool tables, so I was literally carried out of there kicking and screaming, trying to, you know, beat his little skinny butt. But so I started dating this other guy. Yes, imagine that. Alcoholic relationships. dating and breaking up and dating and breaking up. Nothing good, you know. So the last guy that I dated, we dated for a while. Wasn't good. But one morning he woke up and he said, I got to go to a meeting. And it was a Sunday morning. I was like, you have a meeting for work on a Sunday? He said, no, I got to go to a meeting. Well, I was hungover, of course, and I wasn't really paying attention to what he was talking about. So I ended up, like, he left, and I went to the bar. And then he came back later that evening, and he said what he had done. I was like, oh, okay, why? You know, he's like, well, things are whatever. Things are just going crazy. So during that next week, I just went on benders. The last night before I came in, I started drinking at like, I don't know, maybe 3 in the afternoon when I got off work. And just shots, beer. I mean, I would start off my night every single night with a beer and a shot of Grand Marnier. That's how I began my night. And then I would continue drinking. I mean, I'd down the beer, shot of Grandma, go and get some Coke. And that was the beginning of my evening. So this last, my last night of drinking, I ended up starting the usual way, and then I blacked out, came back to, and I was in the driver's seat, and I had my dealer in the window, and he was even saying, Kat, you know, you smell pretty bad. You shouldn't be driving. Should have taken a clue there. And then I came back to, and I was over at somebody's house, and then I came back to, and I was getting out of a pool, and then I came back to, and I was in my car, and then I came back to, and I was hitting the curb with my car. And so, you know, I pulled over, I busted out that tire and messed up the wheel. And so I made a phone call to a friend of mine who I was trying to call everybody, you know, please come help me. You know, I screwed up, I'm drunk, I'm, you know, I'm stuck on the side of the road. And only one person answered my phone call, and he is actually, he was asleep in the parking lot of the bar that I used to go to all the time. And he was like, well, I'm sober enough now, I'll come and help you out. So he came, he changed my tire, and so then I went home. And then as soon as I got home, it was, I don't know, 4-something in the morning, 5 in the morning, and I started calling the guy I was dating just constantly. And, you know, I was crying. I was like, I hate my life. I hate how everything's, you know, how everything is. I'm not happy. I just, you know, I need a change. And so that, I guess it was a little while later that morning, he called me back and he was like, would you be interested in going to a meeting? I said yes. And so he took me to my first meeting this time around. And in the meeting, I was the only girl, which was fine. I'm used to being friends with guys. And it was scary for me. Because in one way I knew that I wanted it, and another way I was just, I didn't know what was going on. You know, I didn't know if I was doing it for him, you know, because he had gone in, and I was like, well, fuck, I might as well go in, you know, because I don't have anything else going on in my life. I'm lonely. I'm not happy. So I ended up, I stayed. I joined that group. I was with Complete Abandon for 6 months. Got my first sponsor there. Her name was Amber. Loved her to death. She ended up moving, and she went to Buffalo. And she's now a mommy. But then I got a second sponsor that I didn't really enjoy calling or talking to or getting along with. So since Amber, when she was here, she introduced me to Frank as Dad. And so I called him Dad. Sometimes I still do. And I didn't know his real name for a few months because I only knew him as Dad. And so then one day we're standing out here at Napa, and somebody was yelling his name. And so finally after the third or fourth time, he turns around and he goes, what? And I was like, oh, so that's your name. So, but I would end up calling him instead of calling my sponsor at the time because I felt more comfortable calling him. And I'd sit there, I'd be crying, going crazy, and I'm sure he, you know, was sitting there going, what the hell's wrong with this chick? This is not what I signed up for when I said I'd be her dad, you know, crying on the phone. Oh my God, what's going on? I hate my life. But he was there for me. Hell, he even helped me move to my new apartment this year. So if you ever need a mover, ask Frank. Well, he carried my couch by himself. I mean, come on, that's a good mover, you know? So anyway, after I left Complete Abandon, I came to NABBA. I found another sponsor who's part of the Tuesday Night Biscayne, and I ended up joining the Tuesday Night meeting at Biscayne. And one night, I was lied to by Dad, telling me that one of the other members at Biscayne wanted me to come out to eat dinner. And so I was on the phone with Frank, almost home, and he said, well, yeah, she's asking about you if you're coming. And I was like, oh, really? And so then I turned around and went and met him at the restaurant. Well, little did I know that that was a lie. She never said that. What ended up happening was he told me that and tried to call her, didn't answer. So he met her at the door of the restaurant and told her what had happened. So she came in and was all sweet, and now we're great friends. That's the Tuesday night. After the Tuesday night meeting over at Biscayne, I always go out to eat. And ever since that night, I've never missed a night. Well, I have missed one night, and that was because I went to the beach for the first time sober ever since I was a little girl. You know, and it's amazing the things that you do when you're sober. Like, my life now, it's so much better. You know, I went to the beach with one of my closest friends, and we sat there, we watched the sunrise, you know, walked on the beach, we went out to eat. There's so many things that it's amazing that my sobriety has brought me. Let's see here. I brought notes because I'm not a good public speaker, so. And that's why I'm hot. Let's see. So I ended up... thanks, Frank. So anyway, after the Tuesday night meeting and joining them, I became more involved. My sponsor, she suggested that I try and get the old Night Owls meeting back together. And so I did. And now we're having our one-year anniversary at the end of this month, which is so cool. I mean, it started off with, like, 6 people showing up, and now we have 30 people showing up. It's really, really neat to have that, and it's a great time, you know. There's a lot of young people. There's not a lot of old people. it is 11 o'clock at night, so, you know, I mean, you got to give them credit. I mean, come on, I love it when Rusty comes, you know. If somebody says that they're too old to go to an 11 o'clock at night meeting, I mean, come on, look at Frank and look at Rusty. I mean, you know, seriously. Rusty's my Santa Claus. So, also, one thing that's also going on is a friend of mine asked me to do a meeting at a program that she runs, and I was like, okay, why not? And I've been doing that for, I don't know, 9 months maybe or so. And that meeting is a really good thing for me. You know, I love all the people there. I've become really, really close to a lot of them. And actually, when I was at the beach, I had Dad come and do the meeting while I was away because, you know, I've got to have somebody take care of it. And he ended up naming the meeting the Alley Cats. Because it didn't have a meeting, they just called it Cats Meeting. And so next thing you know, I get a text from him at the beach saying, yeah, your meeting is now called the Alley Cats. And I was like, what's that all about? And I said, where'd that come from? He said, yeah, some FOT, which means fucking old timer. Because he always calls me an FNC, a fucking newcomer. So, you know, there's a lot of love there. Let's see here. I don't know. I'm pretty much neck deep in AA. I hate speaking, so I'm sorry, guys, if I'm all over the place. I'm on the board over at Biscayne right now. And for me, it's kind of... For me and where I come from and how I grew up, the fact that people, like asked me to tell my story, or they asked me if I'm interested to be on the board, or, you know, do a meeting or something like that. It's just, it's amazing because it's like I always felt like, you know, I was less than growing up. I didn't have anything to offer anybody. And now I don't see it that way. Now I see it that, yeah, I've got something for somebody out there. It may not be, you know, this whole big, you know, huge epiphany of something, but it might be something little minute that, you know, somebody can grab onto and be like, oh, okay, yeah, I see that. This happened to her. Maybe I can do it too. But, you know, another thing, like I mentioned earlier, is I moved into an apartment. I haven't been in an apartment since my second DUI. And so I was living at home with mommy. And in that time is when my mom and my dad got a divorce. And my real dad, he's like I said earlier, he's an alcoholic. He was very verbally abusive and physically. And he would always tell me how, you know, I wasn't worth anything. And now it's like I'm shown that, you know what, I am. I have a huge family here in AA of people that care about me and that I care about. And it's nice to have that, even though some of those people ask me to tell my story, and I really don't like it. But I don't know. I have so much more time to fill. I don't like this. I don't really know what else to say. I've got a good job that I'm reliable, and actually they pulled me into the office on Friday, and I thought I was in trouble because of the way that my manager looked at me, and I was like, oh, crap, what did I do? And my manager said, how would you feel about being the account manager for the vice president of the company? And I was like, holy crap. What, I'm not, you know, of course, the alcoholic thinking, I'm not going to be good enough, I'm going to do it wrong, you know, nothing I do, they're going to end up firing me because I can't do it right, blah, blah, blah. So, of course, I said yes, and there's two other girls that are going up for it, or women, that are going up for the job, and, you know, it's a little nerve-wracking. So this weekend has been a little crazy for me, starting on Friday, all the way through today, hopefully in a few minutes or 20 minutes, I'll be able to sit down. So I don't know. It's, you know, all my jobs before, whether in the restaurant industry or not in the restaurant industry, nobody would have even considered me to be promoted to a different level because the medical offices, you know, one woman I saw years after I got let go of that when she said, how are you doing? I remember you coming into work smelling like alcohol all the time. And I was like, oh, I thought I was brushing my teeth and breath mints. I thought that was covering it, you know. So it's nice to be thought of that I can actually do something, you know, that people think that I'm capable of it. Because the first thing I did, of course, as soon as I left work, I freaked out. I called my sponsor, and she's like, well, that's so good. And I'm like, no, it's not. And then I called Dad, and Dad said the same thing, that it's good, and, you know, they obviously think it's something that I'm capable of. And then I called, I don't even know who else I called. I called a friend of mine and just trying to talk to somebody to talk myself down because I was on the road driving, going home, and I was just, you know, I was a ball of nerves, kind of like I am right now. So I really don't know what else to talk about. Because I'm kind of blanking. I mean, Okay, so I have sponsees. I started having sponsees very early on in my sobriety, and then I stopped. I've had a lot of sponsees since I've been sober, and I only have one that has made it to doing her fifth step, and that just happened on Sunday, and it was amazing. It was amazing for me to be there, be able to relate, you know, sit there and say, well, you know, you, just because you did this doesn't mean that you're the only one. You're not an individual, you know, and we talked, and it was, I don't know, it was very spiritual, spending that time and going over that stuff with somebody else's life, because it's so similar, you know, everybody's story is the same yet different. You know, everybody got drunk, the same but different. You know, everybody who used drugs same but different. You know, I mean, if you popped pills, I popped pills. You know, it's the same. But that was great. And then I'm hot. And then relationships and sobriety. Well, the first one that I was in was the one that I was dating, or the one that I was in when I came into sobriety, or to AA I was in, and it was an alcoholic relationship. It was, you know, the whole drinking, fighting, making up, and then just the same thing, same cycle. So when we came in and got sober, we both just kind of went separate directions. I mean, we're both still friends and everything, but I'm one person now, and he's another person now, and that just happens. But it's, you know, everybody's, I can't really expound upon relationships. I mean, everybody's going to have their own relationship in, AA, as long as you make it, as long as you're happy and, you know, you don't, I don't know. I got to stop right there. I can't really talk about relationships as I turn bright red. Yes, I'm the color of the 90-day trip now. So, anyway, so the steps. Step one was pretty easy for me. Let's see. Step two was a little bit more difficult because I was very pissed off at God. I was pissed off at God for making me have epilepsy. I was pissed off at God for making me have a thyroid disorder. I was pissed off at God for having an alcoholic father that treated me like crap. I mean, it was just, it was all anger. But now I look at it as, you know, and I have epilepsy so that I can teach people about it, that it's not something scary, that, you know, it's, this is something that happens. If I were to have a seizure right now, fall on the floor, just make sure I don't hurt myself. Don't call 911. Call my mom, because 911 is like $1,500 every time an ambulance comes. I can't afford it. But I'll be fine. Just make sure I don't smack my head or something. So, yeah, I was really pissed off. But I've learned that now, that, you know, and like the experience with my dad, other people have the same experiences, you know. Other people have alcoholic father who doesn't think he's one, or treats them like crap and, you know, tells them they're not worth anything. And, you know, and you learn how to handle that and how to deal with that and who to talk to about things like that. So step three, that was... that's, I think step two and step three kind of came together once I kind of stopped being as pissed off at God as I was. I mean, there was still a little bit of, you know, why am I here type of thing. I don't want to be like my father type of thing. But now I'm glad that I'm here. I'm not glad that I get phone calls from my dad at 9 a.m. already hammered. Because I want this for him. He has the same disease that we all do. It's just his is still active. That's kind of how I have to look at it now. Step four, that was one of those that I was like, oh, yes, okay, I can't wait to do this. Can't wait to do this. Called my sponsor one day. I was freaking out about something. She goes, baby, it's time for you to start your fourth step. And I was like, oh, okay. And so, it took a little while for me to do my fourth step. And then one day it was time to do my fifth step. You know how people say that after they do their fifth step, there's this big spiritual release and everything's just great and everything's off your shoulders? Yeah, not for me. I did my fifth step. I went home, tried to pray and meditate for an hour. That didn't happen. I fell right to sleep. Slept for a couple hours, woke up. I felt like I had been hit by a freight train. Just, I mean, I felt like crap. And then the next day, it was an 18-wheeler. The next day, it was a large pickup truck. The next day, it was a medium-sized pickup truck. You know, and it just kind of went, got better and better, or less and less of feeling like crap. But finally, it was kind of like, okay, it's all out. I feel better. It's, you know, it's not heavy on me anymore. It's more of a release. The sixth step, I think I was ready for that when I came in, although there's still character defects that I hang on to. Like, I wanted to change big time, you know. I didn't want to be who I was. I wasn't comfortable in my skin. And so when it came to being ready, I'm ready. I'm still ready. I'm still working on it. I still have those character defects. It's not going to go away overnight. I have realized that. I mean, I do know people like, you know, Frank here, who's got 23 years, and I know he's still got character defects. I mean, look at him. So seven, you know, I did that. I prayed about things like that. Frank, will you please stop doing that? Eight, I'm still working on that. I think I'll always be working on that. Because I've made amends to a couple of people. The most important, well, one of the most important people that I made amends to is my younger brother, because he and I were so close. We still are. I mean, he gave me my two-year medallion at the Biscayne Tuesday night, my home group over there. And he's a rock, and I did some stuff that, you know, shouldn't do. So I made amends to him. I promised I wasn't going to cry. I made amends to my best friend. And it was funny because when I was making amends to her, it was kind of like, you know, I apologized for certain things. And I'd apologize for certain things. And then in return, she thought that, you know, she felt the same way. And it's just amazing how that works. Because you don't know how other people feel. Let's see, 11. I'm trying to think about something else. 11, sadhu prayer and meditation. Yeah, I do that. I skipped one. I skipped the 10. I try not to skip that one, especially on a daily basis. But, you know, I don't know. I think the most important one for me right now is step 12. You know, doing the meeting, working with my sponsees, because it shows me where I am. And thank you. It shows me where I am and how I am. And, you know, it kind of knocks me back on my butt sometimes, you know, when I go and do these meetings and people remind me of where I came from. It's my makeup all over my face. So it's, you know, it's just the doing the 12-step, talking to other people. My doing fifth step with my sponsee, it's all these things have changed, and I want to make sure that people feel or get it like I do, other than the crying up here, because it's not fun. It's one thing that my sponsor actually has worked with me about, because my growing up, I was always told that crying is bad. Don't ever let him see you cry. And so now it's like all I do is let everybody sing, I hate this shit. It's like, really? Come on. You know? I mean, I wanted to keep it together, but obviously I'm not. So anyway, I guess that's about it. Because if I keep talking, I'll just keep crying, and I don't want to keep crying. So, okay, it's close enough. All right, thanks, everybody.
Thanks for keeping it real, Kat. You did just great.